Episode 38, Simon.
Wow.
How about that?
That's good going.
Yeah.
How are you,
Fred? Good going. I'm fine. How are you?
Yeah. Very well, thanks. Very, very well indeed. Got a touch of spring here. It's nice.
Yeah, that's nice, isn't it? Absolutely. Yeah. Always good to see the sun. Well, I think the episodes are getting better and better, and the guests are getting better and better, just to put some pressure on the person who is going to be with us for the next 60 minutes. It's Randy Thornton. Hi, Randy.
How you doing, Ferry and Simon?
Hi, Randy.
Fine. How are you?
I'm doing very well, thank you. Appreciate you inviting me to be on the podcast.
You're more than welcome, Randy. We hope we can have some interesting topics that we can touch on. We always start with a simple question is, can you tell us, in a nutshell, how you got into this business?
Wow, okay, that's a bit complicated one. I grew up as a musician in school. I was a music major, a trombone performance major in college. And right out of college, I got married, and my wife was a violinist and violist, and we both were extended an opportunity to play with an orchestra in Mexico City for a year. So we packed our bags and moved to Mexico and played in an orchestra in Mexico. And after we'd been down there about a year, my wife got pregnant and decided she didn't want to have a baby in Mexico. So we packed our bags again and came back to the United States. And we were both working as studio musicians, lots of television recording work and record album work and film scores and all so forth. And it kind of centered around the Osmond family, which owned a big recording and production facility in Utah. And that eventually closed up shop, and so we were trying to figure out how we were going to make a living as professional musicians living in Utah. And we decided the best way would be to form our own music production company. And I had a partner by the name of Brian Hoffines, who was also a trombone player. And we started doing work for, custom bespoke jingles and television underscoring and promos and lots of advertising type work, and that eventually became Nonstop Music, which was about 40 years ago, and so we've been doing this for a while, and so Nonstop started 40 years ago, and we were kind of competing against a handful of other companies worldwide that were doing the same thing.
So, Randy, at what point did you become aware of production music per se? If you were doing bespoke music, at what point did you realize there was an opening in production music?
Well, when we started Nonstop, our idea was actually to do a library. We felt as though there was a niche that was available to us and that we could be very good at it. The problem was, back in those days, when you're talking 40 years ago, the barrier to entry was huge financially.
Yeah.
And we just couldn't afford it, because you'd have to rent a big studio and bring an orchestra in and pay for all the copy work and all the production expenses. It was enormous. And so we figured out real quick we couldn't afford to do it on our own. And so we launched into the bespoke side of things because the clients were paying for all the production.
Right.
Back in those days, the clients were not particularly sophisticated on the music publishing side of things, and so most of the time we would end up owning the music after the clients had paid for it, and that became eventually the seed for the production music library.
Because did they already have big studios in Utah at that time?
They had some really good studios in Utah, but we got really lucky. We purchased an old church building that was built in 1895, and it had the old chapel area, had a huge space that we built out a scoring stage so we could accommodate like an 80-piece orchestra on the scoring stage. And that became a real advantage to us, because our competitors in Los Angeles, they had to rent these big scoring stages when they were doing orchestral recording. And we had ours available to us 24/7. So we did a lot in the early days. We did a lot of trailer work, film trailer work, and They'd call us up and give us 48 hours to turn around a film trailer with full, 80-piece orchestra. And our competitors really didn't have that capability because the studios down there were rented out, months in advance for film scores. So it became a real competitive advantage to us. We could turn stuff around quickly. The musicians became very skilled, and they were, they were working 5 and 6 days a week, cranking out film trailers and all sorts of bespoke music.
Were there enough musicians available in Utah to do this work?
Yeah, I think, between the Utah Symphony, which is a world-class symphony orchestra, and then there was the ballet orchestra in town and the opera orchestra, and we also had a huge amount of freelance studio musicians because of the legacy of what the Osmonds left us. It was a real big music town, so we were pretty lucky with that.
So, Randy, we're talking the 80s here. Are we when you started this or earlier?
Yeah, it was 1981. Yeah.
So, right then, were you aware that there were sequences coming down the line? Or, at what point did you realize this is going to change?
Well, back when we started into the library side of the business, there were very few competitors. There were literally 9 or 10 production music libraries that controlled 95% of the business worldwide. And so... Right. Aside from the financial barrier to entry, it was fairly easy to carve out a niche for ourselves. And at one point we kind of decided if we could just capture 1% of the world market, we'd have all the business we ever needed. And I think at the time we exceeded that. But on the production music side of things, there just wasn't that many competitors. In fact, production music was kind of viewed as the ugly stepsister of the industry. No one grew up saying, hey, I want to do production music when I grow up. They wanted to produce record albums, or they wanted to be a star that was out on the road, or they wanted to score films or television shows. But production music was wide open, and there was a huge amount of business available with very few competitors. So it was kind of a golden era for us to hop into that segment of the market.
Yeah.
Do you think that that's now changed, the view that people have about production music? Do you think people now see it as real music, good music?
Well, I think people see it as one of the last areas where people can actually make a consistent living. We've seen several changes over the years. First was when the record industry really kind of imploded on itself, and their production budgets were cut in, maybe 10 cents on the dollar of what they were previously. And so people that concentrated on producing record albums for a living could no longer make a living doing that. And so they jumped into television scoring and even film scoring. And then the television budgets kind of blew up, and so shows that, had very good production budgets with lots of money for live musicians and professional studios and all that kind of stuff, that went away. And so they made the next jump from television scoring into production music because there was still a consistent way to make a living. And for me, my motivation was always, I don't care what the music was being used for. I just wanted to, produce and play and record high quality music regardless of where it was going to be used, and if we could make a living, that's even so much better. So we've been in production music from the very beginning, and it's provided a lifestyle for us that we could actually go home and have a life outside of the recording studio and not have these crazy deadlines that some of the other areas of the business had. It's more of a 9-to-5 approach to recording and production.
So, Randy, when you look at the 40 years looking back, are we in a golden age of production music now, or are we in something else?
Well, I think we're in a very confusing age. It seems like part of the hardest part of my job is just trying to stay up on what the latest trends are and what's changing. Every day there's some new disruptive model that comes along, or there's a new type of client or a new end user that has different needs than what they did 40 years ago. And so it's a very challenging time period. And, as I mentioned, I think there were 9 or 10 companies that were really competing with each other worldwide 40 years ago, and now there's probably 5,000 or 6,000 production music libraries out there, all of which are competing for the same pie, in essence. We have a lot more channels and a lot more users and a lot more content being produced, but I don't believe truly that there's more money being generated in the industry. I think it's very much the same as it was 40 years ago.
But are you looking then at the traditional industry, or if you look at YouTube movies and people who pay for music in YouTube movies, then you could say that the pie has gotten bigger.
Yeah, I think in some ways that area of the business has driven down budgets, though, in the more traditional, if you want to call them traditional. I mean, there's only so many people on the planet, and they can only watch so much programming, and there can only be so much money generated by all of these combined entities. So I'm not convinced that there's that much more money being generated. I just think it's being carved up in a lot more smaller pieces.
But of course, Randy, the production costs have dropped. I mean, as you said, when you started, there was a huge barrier to entry, which was paying for the 80 musicians, the copyists, the studio. Now, of course, a lot of that is done by one guy in his home studio. So, I mean, the costs of producing production music have dropped massively. Is that right?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, technology has drastically changed the way the industry operates. Some for the good and some so not so good. You know, I think people, as long as they have a credit card with a high balance, they can run out and purchase a bunch of equipment and start producing content. That doesn't necessarily mean the content is good. So there's a lot more content out there. There's also a lot of really crappy content that's available. But there's also a lot of really great content being produced by young, aggressive composers that's really nice. So I think it all boils back to the same thing, whether it's produced in someone's home or whether it's produced on a scoring stage with a full orchestra. It's if the content is good, it will get used. At the end of the day, the end user doesn't care how it was produced. They just care that it's relevant and that it's good quality.
So one of the constraints used to be unions, Randy. The unions insisted, you know, that a number of musicians were used on a production. Is that the case in Utah still? Do you have unions sort of saying you must produce some music with real musicians, or is that all gone?
No, I mean, there's the American Federated Musicians, and we have a local chapter here in Utah, but it doesn't really get involved much with the recording industry. We're a right-to-work state, so we can file a union contract if we want, or we can not do a union contract, and I would say right. Probably 95% or higher of all the recording that goes on in Utah is non-union. And I would say that that's the trend, not just in Utah, that's everywhere.
Yeah.
Even the guys that are still doing lots of union work in Los Angeles and New York, they're doing just as much non-union work on the side, or dark dates, as we like to refer to them.
I just want to go back a little bit because the story wasn't completely finished. You had Nonstop, of course.
Yes.
And at a certain point, you sold that to Warner Chappell, right?
That's right. About 15 years ago, Warner Chappell decided that they wanted to get into the music production business. They were kind of one of the last majors that hadn't made that jump. They realized that it was a lucrative area of the business, and so they approached us about selling our business to Warner Chappell. They also didn't have any kind of any kind of personnel to run that area of the business or this new division of the company. And so they hired us on to stick around and run it. So there were three partners in the production music library business. It was me and Brian Hoffines and Mike Daddle. As we negotiated the deal to sell the business, we were able to negotiate an arrangement for all of our employees to stay on, and that became the new core for Warner Chappell Production Music. And then over the next 6 years, as I stuck around, Mike initially was there for a year, and then he left to pursue other things, and Brian and I stuck around to manage the business. And my job as CEO at that time was to run around and try to acquire other companies around the world. So over the next 6 years, we acquired six or seven other companies, other catalogs to merge into our core catalog, and very quickly became quite a large player in the industry.
I remember those days very well because we had a lot of independent labels, and like a year later, we had Randy Thornton who had bought all the labels.
Well, we had a bit of a war chest, but it was an interesting time because, you know, it was also a learning curve for us because we discovered really quickly that just buying more doesn't necessarily equate to more licensing. So it was a bit of a balance between purchasing the correct content and having enough content to be relevant in the marketplace.
That's an interesting thing because I remember from those days that we had clients who approached us and they said, you need to have at least like 200,000 tracks before we want to do a deal with you. They didn't even ask about the quality of the music or what kind of tracks that we have. No, they just set a number, you know, so we had business proposals. If you don't have 200,000 tracks, then we don't do business with you. I thought that was very weird because I think it's always important what you offer the client. But are you saying that when you were trying to purchase other labels, you had the similar problems like, do I need to acquire this label just because I want more tracks, or am I looking for certain music that I need?
Well, for us, it was always about looking for the things that plugged a hole that existed in our existing content, because it didn't do any good for us to go out and acquire a catalog that would cannibalize one of our other catalogs. And so both from the acquisition standpoint as well as the sub-publishing standpoint, when we were sub-publishing third-party catalogs, we were constantly looking for something that was different than what we had. And then secondly, something that was equal to in quality of what we already had. You know, it's interesting, when we first started Nonstop, we hit the market with six CDs. And with six CDs, the first year we generated $300,000 just with six CDs. And then everybody was telling us, well, really in order to compete in the marketplace, you've got to have a catalog with 30 CDs. And that was kind of the benchmark. And so we gradually produced more CDs until we had 30. And then we thought, oh, okay, we've made it. We've got 30 CDs of high-quality music. We can really start to make a difference in the marketplace. And then the next benchmark was everybody said, well, when you've got 100 CDs, you can really do well. And over the years, that gradually increased. You know, you needed 500 CDs or you needed 1,000 CDs or, you know, companies like Universal that have hundreds and hundreds of thousands of tracks. It's like, when is enough music? And for us, I think we learned over the years that the most important thing was that we had relevant music and that the music was high quality, because we're never going to, I don't care who you are or how big your company is, there's always going to be a lot more music out there with the competition. And so the only way to compete is to have, in my opinion, is to have content that is relevant and high quality. And then you've got to have some kind of consistent release schedule so that people don't forget who you are.
So, Randy, after your stint at Warner Chappell, what happened next?
Well, I stuck around for 6 years and decided at that point that, you know, I'd had enough fun being CEO and doing all of the high-level administrative kind of stuff, and wanted to really get back more of my hands on the production of music again. And so I left Warner Chappell and joined my grown kids and formed a family business, Amphibious Zoo Music, and started all over again from scratch. And
when was that, Randy? What year?
That would have been about 12 years ago.
Okay.
Yeah.
So how big is Amphibious Zoo now? Is it thousands of CDs? Or?
We're not thousands of CDs. We're a small boutique player because, you know, to become a Warner Chappell or a Universal or a Sony EMI from scratch would take a lifetime, if not if it's even doable at this point. So the approach that we took was we wanted to be a boutique player that specialized in specific genres. And, you know, we'd had enough experience in the industry to know what those genres needed to be. And it's been quite successful. I mean, it's exceeded our expectations, and we're making a nice living for ourselves. And I have the opportunity to work with my kids every day and my wife. So it's a fun opportunity.
Well, can I ask you why you started again? Is it the love for music?
Well, I think it's just I wasn't ready to hang up my skates, you know. I love music. I love what I do. There's not a day that I go into work where I don't enjoy what I'm doing. And I told myself a long time ago that if I couldn't enjoy what I was doing for a job every day, that I would leave and do something else. It's just not worth it. There's easier ways to make money than the music business. But I love the music business. I love love recording and producing and writing and doing all the things involved. And so it's just been a lot of fun.
So Randy, if you were to start another label now, how different would your approach be to the approach you took starting one 12 years ago?
Wow, that's a good question. First of all, I think it's much more difficult today than it was even 12 years ago. The competition is fierce. As we've already discussed, the barrier to entry is much lower. Most definitely I would seek out to have the distribution sub-published by someone else. We do everything in-house, all of our publishing admin, all of our sales, all of our music supervision, all of our publishing, everything is done in-house. If I were to start today, I'm not sure that would be a possibility. I think it would be cost prohibitive. But, you know, we've been able to grow a sizable staff that takes care of all this, so we kind of operate like a mini major. But, you know, that would be a hard thing to start today doing. I think I would partner up with someone.
Well, would you still be working with sub-publishers, or would you just use publishers for admin deals?
Well, I think that's the big question in the future. I think a lot of people want to say, well, is all we got to do is have a website and spend a bunch of money on marketing, and then we'll have someone that does the admin for us in the different territories. But that doesn't get your music placed. I mean, there are so many websites and so much clutter in the marketing and advertising of production music that I think, from my perspective, just spending a few million dollars on marketing and have some okay content is not enough. At least from our perspective, the licensing and the placements that happen more often happen because of relationships. And it's really difficult to have a relationship with just having a website. So I don't know if that answers your question or not, Ferry.
Absolutely. It's interesting because we hear that more than often, that it's a people's business.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's an interesting concept, because if you look at the concept of, for example, Artlist and Epidemic, I don't think that they look at it like a people's business.
Oh, not at all. I mean, to them, it's a technology business. A lot of these newcomers to the industry don't come from a music background. They come from a technology background, or they come from an investment background. And, you know, one of the new players in the industry just got a $30 million infusion of capital, and they're basically spending it on website and online marketing, not so much on content, you know, which I think is really backwards. I think anybody can drop a bunch of money to put a flashy website and spend a lot of money on Facebook and YouTube and so forth. But I'm not convinced that that's going to generate a long-term sustainable cash flow for them.
But still, they are disturbing the market right now.
Yep, no doubt about it. I mean, there's certain segments of the market that have really been disrupted. You know, for example, the YouTube market, the corporate market, people that don't necessarily pay all that much attention to the quality that's being produced. For them, they want you know, stack it deep and sell it cheap type pricing. And I think that's quite different from, you know, the market that Amphibia Zoo competes in, which is more in the film trailer and the advertising and the television market, which still places a premium on the quality of the music. And now, you know, it's possible at some point that the artlists of the world will disturb that part of the market as well, but so far we haven't experienced that.
Randy, don't you think that some of the young guys making their videos on YouTube are going to gravitate towards TV? They'll be promoted into TV and they'll bring their loyalties to production music they know into the mainstream business. I mean, that's the training ground, isn't it, at the moment, is YouTube. I mean, it strikes me that libraries, traditional production music libraries, are not paying enough attention to user-generated material, because that is the breeding ground for the future filmmakers, TV makers, to my mind. So, I mean, it seems to me that we should be paying more attention to that.
Yeah, I guess the question is, what are we paying? I mean, in what way are we paying attention? Because, you know, at the end of the day, music is music. And once you get a volume of music that is just so enormous that the average person can't even be bothered to listen through more than 2-3% of what's out there, in my opinion, the only thing that's going to rise to the top is the stuff that's the highest quality. And it's not just production values, it's also a knowledge of what works and what's relevant for clients. And then, you know, for most of our clients, it still comes back to relationships, because they don't have time to listen through, you know, hundreds of thousands of tracks. They come to us because they value our acumen when it comes to the type of music that will work in a specific program. We have a lot of television shows and a lot of advertising type clients that come to us, and they don't even go anywhere else because they don't have time. We have that relationship. They come to us and they say, okay, can you help fill the need that we have? We don't have time to deal with all of this. So those kind of relationships take years to develop. Now, sure, the disruptors are going to come along and they're going to try to compete on price. But for some of these people, price is not really the concern. If you've got a $300 million film that's being released and you've got a trailer being produced, they could care less that they could get an artlist deal for $15 a month. That's just irrelevant to them. They just need something that's appropriate. So it just depends on what area of the market you want to compete in, and the relationships that you've got, and whether you can continue to keep those relationships up long term. I mean, for me, a lot of the people that I worked with 40 years ago are out of the business or they're dead. You know, so it's a challenge. I'm the oldest person that works. I'm 65 years old. I'm the oldest person at our company. Most of the people that work in my company are in their 20s or 30s. And that's great. That's the way it should be. I mean, we're developing the next generation of people with relationships and developing those tastes in music that are relevant for the clients. And most of our composers are on the younger side as well. But we cherry pick and pick the people that are most appropriate.
I'm just wondering, I understand what you're saying, that you have great music and there's added value because you can help your clients pick the right track. But are also certain things that we can learn from those disruptors? Are there certain things that we should take a good look at and think, wow?
Well, I think the disruptors, I hate that word disruptors, by the way. I think they're just competitors, you know. But I think one of the things that we've learned personally is an appreciation for their technology. I mean, the websites and the ability for people to make the process easier, I think, is something that we can all learn from. I guess what I'm just trying to say is that just because their processes are easier doesn't necessarily make their content competitive. But what we have learned is that these guys are very savvy with their technology, and there's no reason why we can't implement that same technology, at least to a certain level. We don't have a $30 million war chest to spend on a website, but we can take the elements that they offer and help to improve the way our client interfaces. But what I don't want to see happen is for that to replace the personal relationships, because at the end of the day, you know, a trailer house or an advertising agency that's going to spend, you know, $20,000, $30,000 on a single drop of music, they're not going to sit and comb through a website for 2 weeks trying to find the ultimate track. They're going to come to someone that they know. So it's, I think the combination of the two elements is probably the most appropriate, at least for us right now.
It's interesting what you say about technology, because I always have the feeling they have great technology, but they can also afford it because their website is accessible worldwide. For example, if I look at All Music Publishing, we only deal with the Benelux. We need to compete on a technical level with those websites, but our territory is only three small countries.
Yeah, that's a very difficult situation, because the expectation from the user is that you have the same type of technology and the same type of interaction technologically that the big players, the big technology players have. But trying to accomplish that as a small player in a small territory has got to be super challenging.
So is that relevant, that business model that Ferry's describing? Or is it just, are you saying it's just, it's not a goer?
Well, I think right now it's still relevant. I mean, in order for someone to do it themselves and do a worldwide marketing and worldwide distribution and worldwide admin, that takes a sizable amount of people. And it's not just the bodies that's important. You've got to have the relationships with the societies. You've got to know all the intricacies of each society, which is a complete nightmare. Every single territory has their own challenges. And not only that, you've got to have a really in-depth understanding of the marketplace and what the personalities of the users are and what they expect and what their needs are. And to do that all using just technology, I think would be a really challenging proposition, in my opinion.
So, I mean, one of the unique things about the disruptors, or some of them, is that they're bypassing the PROs. So do you think the PROs are kind of doing enough to help traditional libraries like yourself?
Well, I would say no. They never have, and they probably never will. I don't think that the PROs... I think the PROs are somewhat out of touch with what actually gets used in the marketplace. I was the president of the Production Music Association for 6 years, and we spent a lot of time and a lot of money doing research and working with, trying to work with the PROs to help educate them as to how much production music was actually airing on radio, television, film. And personally, I feel like for the most part, it's just been lip service. It's like, yeah, we got you guys are the best. We want to help you get your fair share. But at the end of the day, they're much more interested in helping, you know, Bruno Mars or Madonna or whoever it might be collect their royalties than they are a no-name production company.
Is it an image thing? Is that an image problem?
Yeah,
that we have?
I think so. As I mentioned earlier in the podcast, people don't grow up saying, "Hey, I want to produce production music when I get big." It's just people don't understand what it is. They don't realize the extent that it's being used. I mean, when I sit down and go to dinner with some friends that are out of the industry and they ask me what kind of projects we've been working on or where our music's been airing, they are just absolutely blown away. They just can't even believe that we're dealing at that level of business in the entertainment industry, but people don't understand that or don't appreciate that outside of our own little niche of the industry. Even the rest of the music industry doesn't understand it or appreciate it. So it's hard. I guess it's to be expected that the PROs don't really give it the attention it deserves.
Are they going to pay a price for this?
Well, I think if the disruptors continue to work outside of the societies, eventually that can only have a negative effect on the societies. I think what will really be hurtful to the societies is if the disruptors cross over into the traditional areas of the business, film, television, and these, you know, all of these societies collect their money based upon blankets that they charge these channels. And if the channel can prove to the society, hey, 50-60% of the music that I use is outside of your society, then it only goes to, you know, you would only assume that the blankets would decrease, which means that the amount of money that's paid out to the libraries that are with inside of the society will decrease. So in my opinion, it's a slippery slope. The guys that work outside of the societies are helping to undermine the societies. If the societies are undermined, our business is not a sustainable business model, in my opinion, because it'll become a quick slide to the bottom where it's whatever the cheapest price is. And what's $15 a month at Artlist will become, you know, $5 a month at the next technology competitor.
So, Randy, it may be different in America, but in the UK and Europe, this process is well down the line. I mean, the BBC is using over 20 royalty-free libraries now. So, that, you know, I run a traditional MCPS-based library, so that's the opposition. It's not just my fellow libraries, it's 24 royalty-free libraries that are obviously doing deals with the BBC that undercut the MCPS deal. Scandinavia has been decimated by royalty-free libraries. I'm talking about the broadcast side of things. So, you know, this process perhaps is not so developed in America, but here we're really feeling the pressure from it. And we're looking to our PROs to kind of help, really. But you're kind of saying it's a bit of a vain hope.
Well, I'm not exactly sure how different it is in the UK to the US, but, you know, we don't have a rate card on pricing with the society like you have in the UK. So it's always been, you're always negotiating the price of the license here in the US. But for us, our experience has been, when we charge low fee, trying to be the low cost leader in any kind of negotiation that's going on, it always works against us. We've always taken the approach that we want to be on the upper end of the pricing model, because then people value, they equate a high price with high quality, even though it may have nothing to do with that. And I think as an industry, whether you want to be classified as a disruptor or even one of the mainstream catalogs that are out there, that pricing at the top end of the tier is almost always the correct choice and benefits you in the long term. And by the way, Simon, I would just mention, it's not just these 20 royalty-free catalogs that are doing this. All of the majors are involved in this kind of stuff, and most of the second-tier catalogs are also involved. I think people are a bit panicked at this point, and so they just grab whatever they can. And at the majors, where you've got stockholders that have to be satisfied every quarter, they're willing to do all sorts of crazy blanket deals that are undercutting the rest of the market by 50%, because they've got people with their thumb on their head saying, you've got to hit these numbers by the end of the quarter or you're out of a job. So it's a bit of a turbulent time period right now for the production music industry.
Are you saying that majors are also offering deals to television stations?
Oh, absolutely.
For cheap rates?
Absolutely. I think in the industry, there's very little difference between the majors and the disruptors. It's just the amount that's going on and the visibility that may or may not be there.
So do you look enviously at the UK rate card, or do you think, what a joke that is?
Well, I would say this. In one way, it would be wonderful not to have to be negotiating on a price all the time. But on the other hand, I would hate to be receiving license fees that are as low as the UK rate card. I couldn't stay in business. You know, the fees that we're collecting from most of our clients in the US are, you know, anywhere from 5 to 10 times as much as you're receiving in the UK. So I think in a lot of ways, the UK's done a misservice with the rate card because the fees are so low. For example, trailers. It's not unusual to collect a $20,000 fee for a use of 5 or 6 seconds of a track in a trailer in the US. In the UK, that same license fee would probably be less than $1,000. So it just doesn't make any sense in mind. And it's not like the UK is just producing product for the UK market. It goes worldwide. So why do these rates have to be so low? I just don't understand.
So maybe because they're not used to the rates that you were used to in the States? Because the UK didn't have that trailer industry like you had?
Yeah, it's not just trailer, though. It's advertising, it's television production. The UK exports product all over the world. And in my opinion, I don't see why those rates should be any different than what we're collecting here in the US.
Well, and also you're saying that, in fact, the majors are undercutting the rate card anyway. So the rate, you know, what value does the rate card have in that sense?
Yeah, I mean, if the rate card was done away with in the UK, I don't know if that would benefit. I don't know what the end result would be. It could be that it would cause just a race to the bottom where everybody was trying to undercut everybody all the time. I have very mixed feelings about it because on one hand, I would love not to have to have that part of the business, which takes a lot of time and energy to negotiate back and forth on pricing. But at the same time, I wouldn't want to be locked into a rate card that's as low as the UK.
Aren't you afraid that international companies would go and have everything produced in the UK instead of the US then, because the rate card is so low?
Well, I think there is some of that goes on for sure, especially in the trailer industry. It's not unusual to have a rate card submission for a trailer that it's a worldwide distribution of the trailer. We push back in most of the film studios in Hollywood that are also producing some content in the trailer world in the UK. We push back when they come to us and say, hey, we're licensing this cue in the UK. And we're like, no, you're not, unless you're going to just release it in the UK, because that's, I don't know. Like I say, in the trailer world, the price of a trailer, the music for a trailer, is really insignificant in their overall marketing budget, so it's not such a big problem for us. But if we had a rate card in the U.S., I think most of the companies here would take a huge financial hit.
I just want to talk a little bit about the significance of production music, because I think it was the IPMG who released two research things that they did, and I think it was, I'm just doing this out of my at the top of my head, so I don't know whether it's correct, but I think it was Germany and the UK, and what they said is that like 60% of the music being used on television was production music in these countries.
Yeah, when I was at the PMA, we had a similar survey done, and we came up with about 65% of the music on television was production music.
And that was in the States?
Yes.
Well, if 65% of the production music, of the music on television is production music, shouldn't the PRO just listen to us? And we should tell them what to do?
Well, you would think so. But we have never really had a strong voice with the PROs. The clients don't really care about the production music industry. They don't care that we're getting our fair share. The PROs are primarily, at least in the U.S., are primarily controlled by either CEOs or high-level executives at the major publishing companies and record labels. And for them, the production music income is still a small fraction of what they generate in other areas of their business. And so the clients that are paying into the channels that are paying into the blankets that fund the PROs, they don't want to pay any more money. So, you know, that's a non-starter with them. And the people that are controlling the PROs, they don't want to redistribute that money because it affects the areas of the business that are most important to them. If you're the CEO of the Warner Music Group, it doesn't make much sense to you to take money out of your core publishing company or out of your record label and redistribute that to production music companies, which is a bit of unknown. They don't know whether that's going to benefit them the same as a major or whether they're going to take a hit. So it's the status quo is a safer option for them. So at the end of the day, we hear lots of lip service as to what, you know, how much they care about us and how much they appreciate it, us and how much they appreciate us holding the line and not working outside of the PRO, but the money coming to us never increases. It's always the same.
Randy, if you were able to put a pair of glasses on and look at the future, how do you say, let's say 5 years' time, how would you see the landscape change? Do you think we'll have fewer PROs, maybe one PRO? Do you think we'll have fewer production music companies? Where do you think it's all going?
Wow.
Sorry, difficult question.
Difficult question.
I still got 14 minutes.
Yeah. I can't see there only being one PRO. All these PROs don't get along. They talk a good game, but at the end of the day, they really only care about the money that's coming to their constituents. So them combining and operating as one PRO, I will be very surprised if that happens. Unless things get so bad that they don't feel like they can survive as a concept, you know.
What about a disruptive PRO? Somebody coming in and saying, look, guys, you know, we can do a better job for you. Bring your material to us.
Well, they've already tried that, and I'm not sure that it has necessarily become a significant player.
Disruptors, yeah, I don't know. You know, you can't choose the disruptor, can you? I mean, they just come, Napster hit us, we didn't expect it. Epidemic, you know, there might be signs saying these are the guys, but what makes a successful disruptor is a lot of things, including sort of luck and synchronicity. So, I mean,
absolutely. I mean, a lot of it's just being the first one to market, you know. If you're the first disruptor, then you're going to get a huge market share. With the disruptors, if everybody's charging $15 a month for a license, for a blanket, and you've got 20 or 30 disruptors all charging $15 a month, you have no advantage in any way. You can have, everybody's going to have nice websites, everybody's going to have great technology, and everybody's going to have, you know, bottom feeder license fees, and then all of a sudden, what advantage do they have? So, to me, everybody needs to wake up and realize that we have to have a sustainable business model, whatever that is. It has to make sense financially, otherwise you're going to be out of business in 10 years, and everybody's going to lose those $30 million, $50 million investments that they've got in these things.
Do you think that it's a hype? Do you think that, for example, Epidemic Sound, which is valued at $1.3 billion, and I think that's worth more than all the majors combined, where production music is concerned. Do you think it's a hype?
I don't know. I'm not privy to Epidemic's financials, but...
Let me put it in a different way. They have like 30,000 copyrights, and the company is worth $1.3 billion.
How much money are they generating per year in revenue?
They're losing.
They're losing money.
Yeah, well, there's your answer. There's not really a whole lot of value there. I think it's just like the technology companies that operate for 5 or 6 or 10 years losing money, and then they sell for several $1 billion, and then the company disappears 2 years later because it's been folded into a corporation that actually operates on a normal business model, and they realize, we can't afford to lose $50 million a year or $100 million a year for too long while we're waiting for this thing to catch up, and it goes away. So I think operating on a name only and a technology that is not generating a profit can only go on for so long before it disappears. Even the richest people in the world only want to lose money for so long.
Isn't it possible there's a hidden value that we don't know about?
I'd like to know what it is, if there is. I mean, maybe they know a secret that I don't, but it does not seem sustainable to me.
Well, I mean, I don't think sensible Wall Street investors are just going to pour money into something that's, a house of cards. They must see some value in it.
Well, that's been going on for years in the technology market. But at the end of the day, there has to be some play that they've got in mind that will make that technology leapfrog into a profitable stance. And I'm not sure that production music libraries that are operating on a loss to the extent that some of these disruptors are, that I don't see what they could possibly do to make that profitable and to recoup the amount of money they've got invested. It just doesn't make sense to me.
Mm. Does it make sense that we are a business-to-business company? They consider themselves as a business-to-consumer company?
Oh, they definitely do, yeah.
Yeah, but, so there's a lot more market for them than for us.
Yeah, if it's scalable, but I mean, I think it gets back to the same thing. I mean, in that area of the market, if you're a YouTuber or social media guru or whatever, I think there's just as much money that's being, or as much music that's being stolen and used without payment as there is that's, you know, licenses that are going on with the disruptors. I mean, maybe their end game is that the fees will be so low that even the people that would normally steal the music are willing to pay the fees because they don't want to have to deal with all of the shutdowns and things that happen with stolen music. I don't know.
My experience of my music being stolen, and masses of it is nothing to do with how cheap people are. It's just to do with whether they think they can get away with it. So major corporations in the Far East are using my music. Mm-hmm. Completely unlicensed. It's not because they can't afford it. They just don't see the point.
Yeah, they just don't care.
They don't care.
Yeah.
So, I mean, do you have a beef with YouTube for basically giving the opportunity for these people just to steal our music?
Yeah, of course. I mean, YouTube obviously has the technology to put a stop to any of this. They just choose not to because they don't care. You know, at the end of the day, it's not that important to them. They can talk about intellectual property and how they stand up for intellectual property all they want, but that only applies to everybody but not the music providers.
So on the one side, you've got YouTube taking that stance. On the other side is all us lot, all the libraries, kind of laying down and letting it happen. Why are we not taking out a class action against these guys and saying, we've had enough?
Good question, Simon. I think we would be the first one to contribute to that type of an effort. But, you know, the other problem is that for every one of us small libraries out there that are being ripped off by various large corporations or technology giants, at the end of the day, each of the small players are worried about upsetting the apple cart because they do have some revenue flow that they want to protect. You know, if Disney or 20th Century Fox or one of the big players was using some of your music and stealing it without playing it, and I'm not saying they are, I'm just using that as an example, would you really be willing to bring a lawsuit against Disney to try to recoup on a few uses that were stolen, knowing that a big percentage of your income comes from Disney and you don't want to be cut off from that? I mean, that's a serious consideration. And I think a lot of the smaller players, they either feel like it's a hopeless cause to try to go up against a Google, or they're afraid of upsetting the small apple cart that they already have. That's just my speculation.
Sure. I think that's a very interesting standpoint, and I totally agree with you. It's good to have principles, but at what price?
Yeah.
I mean, isn't it a possibility that companies like Disney, Netflix, Sky are already doing it? They get their own libraries, so they won't need an exterior library. They'll build their own libraries, so they won't need us.
Well, I guess that's always an option, but that's been going on for decades. The appetite and the volume of music that these large users need and that their creatives demand, I think, at the end of the day, what a Disney or another large entertainment corporation spends on music is minuscule in the overall scheme of things. So the fact that they could save, you know, a couple million bucks a year or $5 million a year on music is really not going to be a serious consideration for them, in my opinion.
And I also think it shouldn't matter, because what really matters is the right piece of music to enhance the video that you have and make it a better product.
Yeah, exactly. Now, I think that, you know, the farther down the food chain you get to the smaller player, all the way down to the YouTubers, the exact right cue is not quite as important. You know, it becomes a little bit more like wallpaper. But, you know, when you're dealing with the high-end clients, if your music is 15, 20% more than the competitors, it doesn't matter. They just need the right thing. But that's, Simon, back to your observation about the rate card. That's where the rate card works against you.
Yeah, yeah. So, I mean, also,
because you can't monetize the quality of your music.
Yeah, I mean, you know, when we're dealing with some of the high-end players, we have different tiers. We have, like, okay, this is our premium collection here that is recorded with live orchestra in a big scoring stage somewhere in the world. We're not going to license that for $100. You know, that cue is going to cost you $10,000 a drop. And if it's the right cue for their purposes, no problem. We like that cue. Because $10,000 to them is nothing in the overall scheme of things.
There you go.
Was that the answer you're looking for, Simon?
Yeah, it's very helpful.
Probably not.
It's very interesting to get your perspective, Randy. And, I feel we could go on talking for another hour, but I'm conscious that we've only got a few minutes left, so I'm not going to ask another deep existential question, even though I'd love to. But okay, I will.
You don't want to ask me about the meaning of life or something like that?
I'll ask you the meaning of music. What the distinction between library music and commercial music has been our bread and butter, but on the library side, that distinction seems to me to be breaking down. And I wonder if you could see in the future a point at which there is no distinction between production music and commercial music. It's just music.
Well, I think the only distinction right now is the cost. You know, if the major publishers and record labels start lowering their license fees, then there will be no distinction. There, I mean, in reality, there's no difference. It's this. The quality is very similar in nature. And unless it's a hit song that everybody knows and relates to the artist, there's not really a benefit to licensing a commercial track over a library track. Then it just becomes a function of whether it's the right piece of music and whether it's affordable.
And whether the commercial producers of commercial music get a bit more savvy and realize that at the end of the session, they do a version without the vocals, they do a few loop versions, they do a 30-second version. In other words, they start to learn some of the tricks that we use to make our music more useful.
Yeah, I mean, they're already doing that. I mean, it's because the record industry, the money flowing back to artists in the record industry has diminished. You know, the record companies have grown because of all the Spotify and streaming deals. But the money coming back to individual artists is not as great as it once was, from at least that's my perspective. And so they are searching for all sorts of ways to monetize their content, and competing in the production music space is just one of them.
Okay.
So instead of 9 competitors that you had when you started Nonstop Music, there are now 5,000 and counting.
Yeah, I don't even think it's possible to know how many competitors there are now. I mean, there are, you know, if not thousands, tens of thousands of competitors, because now, because of technology, it's not just a matter of different production music companies. You're dealing with individual composers that have launched their own libraries. And we actually sub-publish quite a few of these individual composers' catalogs, and it's worked out very well for us, because we've got composers that want to dip their feet into the production music world, but they have absolutely no way to get it distributed and administration and so forth. So those collaborations from our standpoint has worked out quite well with us, for us.
Well, this is the end of the episode. It's almost an hour. I want to say thank you very much, Randy, for accepting our invite and being with us for an hour. It's very interesting. Thank you.
My pleasure. Hopefully none of your listeners slipped into a coma, but we'll
I'm sure they didn't.
No, great stuff, Randy. Thanks very much for giving us the benefit of your knowledge and hard-earned experience.
Okay. And for those of you that aren't familiar with Amphibia Zoo music, check us out online. I think you'll like it.
Excellent.
Well, this is the end of this episode. In 2 weeks, we will be back. If you're listening on one of your favorite podcast platforms, please give us the thumbs up, give us 5 stars, and let us know that you appreciate our episodes. You can also visit our Facebook page, facebook.com/synchronizedpodcasts, and follow us there and let us know what you think. And if you have questions, do share them with us. Simon, we're going to do another one in 2 weeks?
Yeah, that said it all for you. Good job.
Bye now.
Bye now.
Bye-bye.